Pilot the Bombardier, Pilot the Bombardier, podcast is ready. Bombardier the pilot, Bombardier the pilot, podcast is away.
Okay, so welcome to this, my second podcast here for the private pilot. Before I start, I just want to point one thing out to everybody, because I know I forgot to do it the last time. I am not a certified flight instructor. I am not a CFI, I'm not a CFII, not an MEI. So what I'm giving you is basically advice based on my own experiences. You can choose to follow the advice or not follow the advice. That's perfectly fine. It's perfectly up to you. Whichever one you decide to do, you know, more power to you. Like I said, it's all up to you. And it's basically just simple advice from one pilot to another. Having said that, this is going to be a really fun episode. I've got with me today in the studio a friend of mine who flew with me on a flight through the new... just sort of around Philadelphia, actually. We fly very close to Philadelphia. And he's going to be on a little bit later to tell you a little bit about some of his experiences flying with me, and also what he, you know, what he feels about flying in general, because he's not a pilot. And we're going to take all this, we're going to put it all together for you, so you get a nice idea of you know, how flights are and things like that, from the perspective of a pilot. Because remember, you're going to want to take your friends up flying sometime. So now, having said that, I guess it's time for me to go grab my obligatory drink and sit back and relax. And I should point out, by the way, that I pretty much only drink non-alcoholic nowadays. I know that many pilots will kill me for saying that one, especially professional pilots. One thing that the FAA would like you to remember is it's 8 hours from bottle to throttle. So make sure you all stay sober, eh? All right. Anyways, I'll be back in just a few seconds.
Apparently, it was not as big a surprise as we had hoped for.
Okay, welcome back to the Private Pilot Podcast here. Yeah, pretty much. Anyways, we're going to talk to you some more about some of these rules of flight that I mentioned before. I got a really special one for you today. I have some few personal favorites. This happens to be one that's kind of good. I'm actually going to give you two. The first one is rule of flight number 7, which is, when in doubt, hold on to your altitude. No one has ever collided with the sky. The other one is rule number 19. This is by far one of my favorites just because of the way it's phrased. In the ongoing battle between objects made of aluminum going hundreds of miles per hour and the ground going 0 miles per hour, the ground has yet to lose. Now, both of these actually touch on a very, very important thing to think about, which is, you kind of always have to be aware of your surroundings, you kind of always have to be aware of what is going on around you, in a sense, and always remember that no matter what happens, the tendency of your airplane, once the engine is shut off, or once you're not giving it enough power, is to go down. Now, granted, in a small plane like a Cessna or a Piper, you're going to get a decent glide rate, you're actually going to glide down fairly well. You turn into a heavy glider, basically. Now, that's both a good thing and a bad thing, because eventually you're going to get down to the ground. One of the most important things, once you have your private pilot license to practice, is emergency procedure. I go up very frequently, well, not as frequently as I'd like, you'll see from my logbook, but one of the things I do is I actually go up and practice stalls. I go up and I practice an emergency landing every now and then. And the goal is always to do it as cleanly and as crisply as possible. You want to make sure that your airplane handles in a way that you're familiar with. You want to make sure that, above all else, if an emergency should happen, and God forbid one ever should, but if an emergency should happen, you know what to do. As a very good friend of mine told me, practice makes perfect. And this is especially true in flying. Remember that no matter what happens, if you ever have a stall, you need to know how to recover from it. Now, I've been told by many pilots that, you know, Cessna's stall, you let go of the yoke and it kind of recovers by itself. That's great in theory. You know, I wish every plane were that simple, but it's not. Now, what I'm going to do now is I'm actually going to walk you through a stall procedure. And although, like I said earlier, I'm not a CFI, these are things you should know off the top of your head. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk through a stall procedure the way it was taught to me, and you get to sort of at least understand my thinking process as I'm going through this, and what I do should, you know, God forbid a stall ever happen. So, of course, what you're first going to want to do, especially when practicing your stalls, the one kind of stalls that everyone seems to hate the most is the power-on stall. And I guess the reason people don't like it is because your airplane's at full power. You know, it's not a natural setting for a stall. It's a takeoff stall, basically, and it is one of the most dangerous stalls you can have, because you're not very high off the ground, you're not coming into the runway. As a matter of fact, 99 times out of 100, you're leaving the runway behind you. So you have to react quickly, and you gotta think fast, on your feet. You gotta be right there when it happens. What's gonna happen is you're gonna start pulling back, you're gonna pull back, you're gonna pull back. And actually, I saw one of these happen, and I'll tell you about it in 1 second. But you're going to keep pulling back on the stick, you're going to pull back too far, and suddenly you're going to hear that stall warning horn coming over your headphones, over the speakers, whichever you're using, and your plane's going to stall, the nose is going to start dipping, and you got to recover right away. Now, in a power-on stall, to be honest, the easiest way to recover is let the nose dip just enough to give you back that lift and then gently pull back on the stick. The exact procedure for this stall is to release the back pressure on the yoke, level the wings with coordinated aileron and rudder, and then resume normal flight altitude, power, and airspeed with minimum loss of altitude. This is very important. One of the things that stalls are infamous for, of course, is putting a pilot into a spin. We don't want that to happen. Coordinated rudders, coordinated stalls, that's what you're shooting for every single time. So now, of course, power on stalls, that's a takeoff stall. Power off stalls, a landing stall. I've had this happen to me once, actually. Luckily, I was 5 feet over the runway, as I mentioned in the last segment. Once again, you're going to pull your power back, you're going to put yourself into landing configuration. Now, of course, remember with all stalls, when you practice them, do them at altitude. You never, ever want to practice a stall too low. It's always best to be up at altitude when you're practicing them. My instructor always put us right around 3,000 feet, and the goal is to drop as little as possible. So if you think about it that way, you know, just remember that to be on the safe side. Now, for a power-off stall, once your plane starts to stall, you're going to try to constantly keep your wings level and coordinated. So your plane's going to stall, your yoke is fully back, your sink rate is high, and the airplane starts to pitch down. So release your back pressure on the yoke, push the throttle full in by adding full power, level the wings with coordinated aileron and rudders, and once you start to regain altitude, decrease your flaps in increments. And you do that as your airspeed comes back up to normal, and then you resume normal flight altitude with power and airspeed. The goal is, of course, to do this with as little loss of altitude as possible. You don't want to fall 400 or 500 feet when you're doing this. You want to fall a few feet. And by a few feet, I mean you want to fall anywhere from 50 to 100 feet. You don't want a huge stall. That's the worst thing that can possibly happen. As I was mentioning, I was going to tell you about something I saw. I flew out with a friend of mine, actually my roommate, and a girl that he was seeing at the time, out to Rotorfest. It's a helicopter air show that they hold here at Brandywine Airport. Brandywine Airport is right next to the American Helicopter Museum. So, perfect place to hold Rotorfest, of course. So we went out to Rotorfest, and we flew in, which was kind of fun. Had never flown into an air show before, so we had to time it between the air show. It was really kind of weird because the FAA had all these TFRs in place, but I'll go into TFRs at a later date. So anyways, as we're flying into this air show, we land, we get to the air show, everything's perfectly fine on the way in. Leaving the air show, we're sitting on the runway waiting to take off. We're third in line for takeoff, and there's a Piper Cub sitting on the runway waiting to take off. The Piper Cub starts rolling, and my guess is that most likely, there were two people in it, most likely there was a student behind the controls. They pulled back. They pulled back hard, and that Cub went straight up. And I mean straight up. That Cub literally went vertical. And you didn't have to hear the stall warning horn. You could see it start stalling. It literally started to come straight back down and pitch over forward. At that point, I think the instructor took over the airplane because they recovered from the stall, but they did not have a lot of space underneath them to recover from. They were looking at maybe a recovery of about 10 feet there. We were all sitting in that, in our airplane with the engine running, thinking, oh crud, we're not going anywhere. We're gonna have to sit here and wait while someone comes and investigates this crash. Now, the honest truth here is that luckily nothing happened. The airplane took off, the airplane flew out, and because of the TFR, I think the instructor kept them up in the air for the remainder of the TFR at least. And as much as I hate to say this, because it's going to sound kind of weird, but just like with riding a horse, remember, you know, if you ever are in a plane crash, because I've had a few friends that have been in crashes with small aircraft, first off, you're much more likely to survive it in a small airplane than you're in a large one. But even more more importantly than that, even more importantly than that, remember that above all else, if you're ever in a crash with a small airplane, don't let it scare you away from flying. Get back up in that saddle, fly again. Above all, be safe. I mean, the more you are conscious as a pilot, the more you are aware of your surroundings, the more you know what's going on with your airplane, the safer you're going to be. The more effort you put into being a safe pilot, the safer a pilot you're going to be. Having said all of this, I'm going to go grab a drink, take a break. So I will leave you to think about what's going on and listen to whatever sound clip I squeeze in the middle here. So have fun.
Hard part about playing chicken is knowing when to flinch.
Okay, so we're all back, and I hope that you're having a fun time playing chicken with the internet, or at least playing chicken with your podcast. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to tell you something. Like I said originally, I'm going to talk some about aviation history. And I figured since I primarily fly the Piper Archer, the PA-28, I was going to give you a little bit of history about it. Basically, the PA-28 is commonly known, if you ever call up an air traffic controller and give them your type as a PA-28, what they're going to do is give you the designator Cherokee, and you'll just be irked by the fact that you're a Cherokee. Now, Piper does have a Cherokee 6, which is a slightly different aircraft. Anyways, the main competitor to this, obviously, is the Cessna 172. Which is the primary trainer. Most people use it. But a lot of people do like the Archer. Basically, at the time of its introduction, Piper's primary single-engine aircraft was the 24, the PA-24, which is a Comanche. It's a larger aircraft. It's got a constant-speed propeller. And the Cherokee basically was a less expensive alternative to this. Now, some Cherokees actually do have retractable gear and constant speed props. Usually those are called aeros. However, not always. So the aero was first introduced actually in 1967. It has the constant speed propeller and the retractable landing gear. It's got a 180 horsepower engine, and in 69 it was upgraded to a 200 horsepower engine. So it's not a high performance airplane. That's something to keep in mind. It is actually not a high-performance airplane. The FAA regulations on high-performance aircraft state that it has to have a 201 horsepower engine. So you can actually fly a aero without having a high-performance rating. You will need a complex rating, however. In 1968, they again modified the aero. They replaced the push-pull style throttle, which is what you have in a Cessna, with a more throttle quad, more modern throttle quadrant, which is kind of what you have if you look into modern-day aircraft. You've got that little thing, that little lever that moves up and down. I happen to love it. It's so much easier to use, in my opinion, anyways. In 1971, Piper then came out with the Cherokee 140. It's a variant called the Cherokee Cruiser 2+2, but kept the 140 designator. It's a four-seater version and had a 150 horsepower engine. In 73, the Cherokee 180 was renamed as the Challenger. Fuselage became longer, wings became wider. The 235 was named the Charger and basically had similar modifications. The Challenger is what eventually becomes the Archer. The Challenger becomes the Archer. It's a PA-28-181. Like I said, I love the Archer. I love flying it. It's an excellent airplane. The wing design is kind of cool. It has a constant chord rectangular planform wing, popularly called the Hershey bar wing because it kind of looks like the flat candy bar. That's what it had originally. Now, what you have now is you actually have a angled root wing, which means that the leading edges is kind of swept forward as it nears the fuselage body. You know, it all depends on what you like flying. The other really nifty thing with the Archer is that instead of having elevators in the back, it has a stabilator, which means the entire tail moves up and down. So when you go out and you do your walk around in the aircraft, you check the entire, basically, wing. The entire thing moves up and down. Now, Cherokees have always used yokes rather than sticks. I guess this is just because that's how they were built. The other really weird thing about the Archer, and you know what, you really get used to it after a while, is the fact that the flaps are controlled by what basically looks like a handbrake on the floor. You have three flap increments. You've got four, actually. You've got 0 degrees, which is the levers flat against the floor. Now, it's right between the two front seats. It's actually right in front of your trim. The next pull is 10 degrees, and then you've got 25 degrees, and then you've got 40 degrees. Now, if you're really confident in your skills, or if you really need more flaps than that, you can add maybe about another 2 or 3 degrees by holding the flap bar all the way back. I've never done that. It's also got differential toe brakes, which is really cool because you can brake the wheels differently. I think most planes have this nowadays, but it's got differential toe brakes. You can brake the wheels differently. It's got a brake lever that's basically underneath the panel. Looks like a handbrake in a car. It too, except that it's vertical. So it's a very cool airplane to fly. I happen to like it. The approximate performance specs on it. It takes off at about, it's got a VX of about 65 knots and about an 80 to 90 knot climb. Once again, a little bit depends on which version you're looking at. If you look at a Warrior, which is 28161, the VX is 63 and the VY is 79, and the VA, the maneuvering speed, is 88 to about 111. I find actually that the Piper Archer, the PA-28-181, cruises very well at about 110. It's got one, obviously as a crew of one, it has a capacity for 3 passengers. You can have one sitting in the co-pilot seat and 2 in the back. It's got about an 800-pound useful load, so you can actually take some luggage if you're not flying a full airplane. If you are flying a full airplane, you're not flying with full passengers, I'll tell you that much. At least, I would not recommend it. But, of course, is up to each individual person, whether they want to or not. So, as I said, they were introduced originally in 1960. So you can tell that it's an aircraft that's been around for a while. I happen to love it, like I said. The maximum speed for an Archer is actually 246 kilometers per hour, so 133 knots. A lot of sites have the normal cruising speed listed at 128. Like I said, 110 is more realistic. The initial rate of climb is about 650 feet per minute, so you get a decent climb in it. Service ceiling, and I've never had it up this high, is listed as 13,240 feet. Honestly, I've never been above about 8,000 with it. 8,000 was the highest I ever got. It's a happy little airplane at 8,000 feet. It's probably a happy little airplane at 9,000 feet. Start getting above that, and it's going to take you a while to get up there. So I don't know, honestly. And that's personal, personal opinion. It has about a 400, I'd say, is a good guess on its range. And that's at 75% power with reserves. It gives you about a 400 knots radius that you can fly in. That's about what I figure when I make my calculations for it, that I've got about 4 hours worth of useful fuel on board. The dimensions, the wingspan's about 35 feet, the length is 23 feet 10 inches, height's about 7 foot 4 inches, and it's got about 170 square foot of wing area. It's powered by a 180 horsepower Textron Lycoming 0360A4M flat 4 engine, and it's a pretty good aircraft. It's actually a very comfortable aircraft, to be perfectly honest. Now, if you're looking for fun little practice in this aircraft, go out to your local flight school, see if they have one. Have them take you up in it. Flying a low-wing aircraft is completely different than flying a high-wing aircraft. For one, what changes, first of all, is your view. You're going to view things completely differently in a low-wing aircraft than you will in a high-wing. Because, you look out the window, and guess what? You have wings blocking your view down. Conversely, in a high-wing aircraft, you have wings blocking your view up. So for sightseeing, obviously, you probably want a high-wing, and for, cruising, you want a low-wing. Although, I find that a low-wing aircraft is actually pretty good for sightseeing, too. You can do a lot with it, and if you got an experienced pilot flying it, you can get nice views out the window. Trick is just banking the airplane properly. Luckily, on the one flight that I had where I needed that, my former flight instructor was with me, and he more than happily banked that airplane enough. Having said that, I don't recommend doing it unless you're comfortable doing it. Anyways, like I said, it's a great aircraft to fly. I love the way it handles. It's a dream. And one of the things I absolutely love about it, and I'll let you in on a little secret as to why I switched to it. Of course, one of the first things you learn in your first 4 hours of flight training is you do a stall. I didn't like the way the Cessna stalled, because in my opinion, and this is purely 100% my opinion, it's why I switched aircraft, in my opinion, when you put the Cessna into a stall, she has a tendency to wing over a little bit, and if you're not quick on that correct, you can move yourself into a spin situation, and I was never really comfortable with that. So when I went and tried the Archer, because I wanted to see what it felt like to fly it, I discovered really quickly that she's an incredibly stable staller. When she stalls flat. And by that I mean basically that she stalls in such a manner that once you stall her, all she does is stall and the nose goes down. No wing left, no wing right. Assuming you've stalled her coordinated, she stalls flat. And as a matter of fact, depending on the weather conditions, she may not stall at all. What you'll feel is you'll hear that stall warning horn go, and you'll feel buffering. And by buffering, I sort of mean the airplane shakes a little bit in the air. You get some stick shaking. And if you just let go of the pressure, the plane will right itself up. It's a wonderful aircraft. I absolutely love flying it. It is the best experience I have on a daily basis whenever I fly an Archer. Now, right now, I'm flying a 2002 Archer, I believe. It's November 340 Papa Alpha is the tail designator. So if you want to go look that up online, there are places you can look up registries. You'll see where she's located out of. Also, if you go to www.wingsfield.com, WINGSfield.com, you'll see the airport I fly out of. You can look it up. You can actually see the airplanes we have in their inventory. They're looking into getting either a new Arrow or a Saratoga for a complex aircraft. I'm hoping they get that Saratoga. I would love to learn to fly the Saratoga, but that's just a personal thing. So anyways, like I said, I'm going to give you a little bit of history. This was a quick, brief overview of the Piper Archer. Next time, I'll probably give you some more relevant history on the history of flight itself. So coming up next, we're going to have an interview with a good friend of mine, Sonny, who flew with me on a trip, a night flight around Philadelphia, and you'll get to hear about flying from a passenger's point of view. So sit tight, and I will be back in just a few seconds. Okay, so welcome back to the Private Pilot Podcast. As I told you earlier, I have a guest with me today. This is Sonny. He was one of the, I think, third passengers I flew, probably?
Yes.
Something like that. And he's here today because he's going to pass on some of his experiences as a passenger in a private pilot flight by a fairly new pilot. So, how'd you like it?
It was great. I had a great time. It was impressive. Flying in a small plane at night, a night flight, seeing the city lights, the weather was nice, ride was smooth. It was pretty good.
Yeah, it was a clear night. Almost no winds. Great from a pilot perspective. We fly just outside of Philadelphia. We flew into Philly Northeast.
Yes.
And on the flight into Philly Northeast, you got all the lights in the background. I mean, you know. So, of course, it's night flight. I'm concentrating on flying the airplane. But, I mean, Sonny, you must have had a few great views of the city, though.
Yeah, they were pretty good views. I think we flew at around, 2,000 feet?
About 2,500, yeah.
Yeah, and, seeing different parts of your city from the air at night is a great perspective. It was quite fun. I took a lot of pictures. And, they came out. Well, some came out, some didn't, of course. You know, you're moving. And,
huh?
But it was pretty good.
Yeah, next time we go up, I'll let you borrow my camera because it's got a faster
steady cam or something.
Yeah, it's got steady cam and it's got a faster shutter, so you can get more pictures that way.
Okay.
But in general, though, I mean, from a passenger perspective, tell us about the experience as a whole. Tell us, you know, what parts of it you really enjoyed, what parts of it could have been better, what parts of it, you know, you found fascinating.
Well, the first thing I was impressed by was the checklist, going over the checklist. You know, it was pretty thorough. Just like it says, it's a list, and you go one by one to see whether each part of the plane worked correctly, how it functions, just to make sure that, you know, once you get up in the air, it's safe. And I'm impressed by the checklist. I think it's pretty thorough. And, that was the first part. It took a while. It took, maybe half hour, I guess, of going through all of the different gauges, making sure things worked, the rudders, feeling the wings and feeling the propellers by hand, just to see if there are see if there's anything wrong with it. There was nothing wrong with it. Of course, it was good, but I'm impressed by that. Going over that checklist first, you know, makes you aware that you're flying in a safe plane. You know, you're checking the fuel to see whether or not there's anything in it. I was first off. impressed by the checklist.
So, checklists were cool.
Yes.
Checking the plane was cool.
Yes.
And then we taxied out and we took off.
Well, before that, it was cold. It's very cold at an airport. And one of the things I was worried about was, when we get up in the plane, is it going to be warm in there? And you said that once the engine warms up, the cockpit heats up, and it did. So
yeah, we're actually pretty fortunate. The airport that I rent out of has brand new 2000, well, brand new, fairly new 2003, 2004 aircraft. So, I mean, you know, it's got heaters, they got air conditioning. I mean, you know, flying in the summer in the horrible humid heat that we get here in Pennsylvania is no fun. So actually having an airplane with air conditioning is kind of nice. But, yeah, so anyways, you were saying we you were the fear of the heat and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, it's a comfortable ride. You said that they had air conditioning, too, so I guess in the summertime it's just as comfortable. It was a little more cramped inside the Piper Archer than I thought a plane would be, but it was still comfortable. Still a comfortable ride.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now I know a lot of new pilots out there start their training in a Cessna, and I actually started mine in a Cessna too. I have maybe 4 hours in a Cessna. For me, I switched over because I just prefer the way the Archer handles. It's a more smooth handling aircraft. Not to say that the Cessna isn't a smooth-handling aircraft. It's the kind of aircraft where, you know, you enter a stall, you let go of the yoke, and the plane fixes itself. But it's the kind of airplane that, you know, just the way it feels flying through the air, I happen to like it. Mm. But I'm guessing that it being cramped didn't cramp the enjoyment of the flight any.
No, not at all. It's interesting that the movement of the plane depends when it's on the ground, even on the propellers. It's not propelled like a car, you know. Like the, you know, it's pulled by the propeller on the ground and steered. The plane is very light, you know, so you can actually push it by hand. And we taxied out to the runway, and there was the I guess what was that on the ground that you do call signals? You speak to the tower. You
I call it. I call it. In this case, I just do a announcement over what's known as a CTAF, Common Traffic Advisory Frequency, because Wings Field has no tower.
Well, hearing that, it sounded very professional when you did it. It sounds like, you know, you're one of the passengers, you hear those things, but it's kind of strange when you hear it inside the cockpit. It sounded very cool, very professional. It's you sounded great. You sound just like a pilot. And yeah, there I go. I'm sitting in a cockpit, and here I go on the runway, about to take off. And this is the whole deal. It's pretty cool.
I would hope that I sound like a pilot.
You did.
But then you also got to hear communications with the Tower Airport, because, like I said, we flew into Philadelphia Northeast, which is a Class Delta airport inside of the Philadelphia Bravo airspace. So you got to hear me talking to Northeast Tower as well, so you got to hear their responses.
Yes.
And I think they did a pretty decent job of controlling the traffic coming in, because that was a busy night, too.
Yeah, it was. There was some news helicopters in the air. They knew where everything was. They were telling you what to watch out for. There might have been some other activity, but I do remember, and I think we saw two of them, and they told us where they were, the helicopters. And, you know, you can see it. While there really isn't anything like traffic on the street, you can see the other planes and helicopters in the air, and you kind of know where they are. They tell you where they are. They tell you where to go and how to steer from them. Besides, there's also that GPS that's on the airplane. Yep. That kind of guides you right where you need to go. All you have to do is keep the airplane right on that line that the GPS tells you to, and you just fly over it. And it makes it easy.
Yeah, for anyone that wants to check out the airport that we fly out of, if you go to AirNav, that's www.airnav.com. The airport identifier is Kilo Lima October Mike. We flew at Wings Field in Bluebell, Pennsylvania. We flew from there into Philadelphia Northeast, which is Kilo Papa November Echo. So if you want to go check those out, those are kind of cool. Like I said, AirNav is a great site for that. It'll give you airport information. It gives you airport diagrams. It gives you approach plates if you need them. So I highly recommend it. I use it for, you know, a lot of research before I go flying into an airport. So anyways, Sonny, thank you for joining me here. Thank you for flying with me.
Yeah, it was fun. I had a great time. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, we're looking forward to another flight. I still have to take Sunny through the northeast, through the VFR corridor up the Hudson, which I spoke to y'all about the last time. And hopefully after that flight, Sunny may be back and tell you more. So, but until then, I will see you later. This is the end of this podcast, and I hope you all had fun listening. Have a good one, and safe flying.